Chapter 17. Besieged. For 2 years, Oberstleutnant Pravit had ruled Colditz as his fiefdom. Now he was in serious personal danger, under threat from the advancing Americans, the SS in the town, and more than 1,000 increasingly assertive prisoners. The code word ordering him to ship out the Prominente had come through at 5 p.m. He summoned Eggers to a council of war. They could ignore the order, but the SS would then undoubtedly storm the castle, probably arrest them both, and seize the special prisoners by force. If the VIPs realized what was happening, some or all of them would surely try to hide or disappear among the teeming prisoners. In those circumstances, we should never catch them at all, even inside the castle, without bloodshed, said Eggers. The prisoners might riot. No telling what they might do if this news got around. There could be a revolt. But if Eggers and Pravit obeyed orders and delivered the Prominente to the SS, they would be held legally responsible for whatever subsequently happened to them. The war was almost over, and there would be an accounting when it was lost. Neither man was a murderer. They knew that the future of these men in SS hands was at best uncertain and at worst extremely short. But the habits of obedience were ingrained, and Himmler's order was explicit. The commandant must hand over the Prominente and would be answerable with his life if any escaped. Pravit and Eggers agreed they would delay making a move until the prisoners were securely in bed. By 10 o'clock, the yard was clear, and all the prisoners were locked in their quarters or the chapel, wrote Eggers. Colonels Todd and Duke were summoned to the commandant's office. Tall and emaciated, Pravit saluted stiffly and invited them to sit. Through an interpreter, he informed the senior officers that the special prisoners would be leaving the castle at midnight. The SS force in the village is supplying the guard to protect the Prominente. He was not at liberty to say where they would be going. Todd's response was immediate and emphatic. We demand that you ignore the orders. Pravit shook his head. The SS troop was just a few hundred yards away. If he did not follow Himmler's orders, then they would do so, with maximum force. If I refuse to obey this order, the SS will carry out reprisals, not only against me, but against the entire castle. There will be many deaths throughout the camp, and still the Prominente will depart. Todd and Duke remonstrated. Allied aircraft were strafing the roads. It would be madness to send out 2 truckloads of prisoners through an ever-narrowing corridor between American and Russian forces, sending them to certain danger and possible death. Duke chimed in. It is your duty as a responsible officer to act independently, exercising your own best judgment. Pravit was unbending. The move will take place tonight. The move will be completed by daybreak. Now they appealed to Pravit's Prussian sense of legal order and his instinct for self-preservation. The Geneva Convention required a detaining power to give 24 hours' notice before moving prisoners and to state their destination. You will be held personally responsible for the abduction of the Prominente, said Todd. Pravit shrugged. They would be guarded by the SS, so the responsibility was theirs. And who will protect them from the SS? Duke demanded. This question gave Pravit pause. The American had a point. If the SS simply executed the prisoners after he handed them over, the Allies might charge him as an accessory to murder. The buck might stop with him. And so, as bosses have tended to do throughout the ages, he passed it on. Pravit gestured towards Reinhold Eggers. His security officer, Hauptmann Eggers, would accompany the VIPs to their destination and then return to Colditz with a letter signed by the Prominente announcing their safe arrival at wherever it might be. Eggers was stunned. At a stroke, Pravit had removed himself from the firing line and placed his subordinate directly in it. My head was a target from both sides in this affair, from my own and from the Allies, Eggers wrote. If the Prominente escaped, Hitler would get me and my family too. If the Prominente were killed, the Allies would finish me off as responsible for their deaths. Todd went straight to the Prominente quarters, where additional sentries had taken up positions to convey the bad news. The men had an hour to pack. He tried to sound reassuring. The situation is changing hourly, and in our favour, Todd said. The Swiss protecting power has had specific warning and requests to follow the movement of any prisoners. You will not be deserted. Charlie Hopeton and Doik Haig were both unwell and had to be hauled out of the sick bay. Maintaining status to the last, the Prominente officers insisted that they were entitled to at least two orderlies to pack and carry their luggage. The other ranks had been crammed into an attic. The orderly officer asked for volunteers, and two New Zealand soldiers, both Maoris, stepped forward. Eggers was astonished that anyone would voluntarily take this trip with their officers into the unknown. Young John Wynant managed to separate himself from the other Prominente and hid in the attics. Florimond Duke was immediately summoned back to Pravit's office. If he has not been found by the time the Prominente are ready to leave, said the commandant, the SS will take up the search. And if they don't find him? Asked Duke. There will be shooting. You and your men are sworn to protect prisoners. What can my handful of old men do against 800 SS troops? Moreover, the SS would seize the opportunity to occupy the prison if the American ambassador's son failed to reappear. That would please the SS commander, said Pravit. He could move his men into the castle to put down the revolt. Once in, they would stay. Duke knew he was right. The castle would be a great spot for a fanatical last stand. Pravit got to his feet. In an hour, an SS detachment will arrive to escort the Prominente. If Lieutenant Wynant is not ready to move with the rest, then God help us all. Refusing to surrender one American would place the life of every other prisoner in jeopardy. I've decided the risk is too great, Duke told Nunn, who went to find Wynant in the attic. At 1:30 in the morning, Captain John Elphinstone, the King's nephew and the most senior British officer of the group, led 21 men across the courtyard and through the gate to the waiting buses. The posse of Prominente now consisted of 7 British officers of varied nobility and notability, the Polish contingent under General Boer Komorowski, 2 Maori orderlies, and a lone American. The other prisoners crowded the windows, shouting encouragement as they departed. Giles Romilly described the moment in a series of snapshot images. General Boer marching out impeccable, castle attempting its Van Gogh look, walls light greenish-yellow, potato cobbles, potato faces, Pravit switching boot, a great moon emerging from behind clouds. They passed through 2 lines of stormtroopers. There was no friendliness to their faces. A black Alsatian hung around their heels. Eggers, wearing a crisp uniform and an expression of deep anxiety, was the first aboard. Flanked by 2 motorcycle outriders and followed by an armoured car, the convoy set off, as if on some hellish holiday excursion, down the hill, over the bridge, and through the deserted streets of Colditz. Friday, the 13th of April, was unnervingly quiet. The very air seemed dead still, like the middle of a typhoon. Distant artillery fire boomed from the direction of Leipzig, but the air raid sirens had fallen silent. The night had been spent wondering what would become of the Prominente. Few slept. Padre Platt claimed to have seen two officers of the SS escort studying a map under the light and speculated that they seemed to be indicating a road veering south in the direction of Berchtesgaden. Rumours swirled and eddied around the castle. Some said Soviet paratroopers were already dropping on Berlin. The optimists claimed the Americans were just over the brow of the hill. Others were doubtful that liberty was truly at hand. "We reckon it is 50-50 on all of us being moved today," wrote Platt. "But where can they move us to?" The most widespread theory was that they would be herded south, destined to become pawns, like the Prominente, in some horrific last stand in the Bavarian Alps. Reinhold Eggers returned in the evening, bringing with him a handwritten note from Elphinstone, confirming that the group had been delivered to Königstein Castle and were safe, for the time being. Eggers liked to exude a schoolmasterly air of omniscience at all times, but even he admitted he had no clue what might be in store for the hostages. The prisoners responded to the uncertainty by gorging themselves. For weeks, they had been eking out the remaining food stocks. Now they ate the lot. Whether the next day brought liberation, a forced march to some Nazi redoubt, or death, they would be well fed. It seems absurd not to eat everything up, for who could know how and when we might eat again, wrote Grizz Davies Scarfield, who carefully listed his consumption that day. Cheese souffle, bread and butter with jam, soup, cold salmon, mashed potato, fried spam, French beans and turnip, cake, chocolate prune pudding, and a delicious cup of coffee. It was another disturbed night, partly due to excitement and anxiety over what tomorrow might bring, but also on account of acute indigestion. At 9 a.m. the next day, the lookout trained his telescope on the signal sight. But instead of leaning on the lamppost as usual, the signaller crossed the road with slow, deliberate steps and then turned to look up at the castle. "You are to be moved." Sure enough, an hour earlier, a two-letter message to Pravit had arrived from German Area Command Headquarters. ZR. Destruction, evacuation. The Prominente were already on the move again. Hopton and Haig were too ill to travel and remained in the sickbay at Königstein with one of the Maori orderlies. But the others were loaded back on the buses for a hopscotch odyssey through a series of camps, each mile taking them further from the advancing Allied armies. South through Czechoslovakia to Katow, then Laufen, and finally Tittmoning, a medieval fortress in southeastern Bavaria near the Austrian border. To the south, beyond Salzburg, lay Berchtesgaden, Hitler's national redoubt, high in the Bavarian Alps. The Alpine Fortress, or Alpenfestung, built around the Bergdorf, or Eagle's Nest, consisted of a system of mighty defensive works, including a command complex of 200,000 square feet, hollowed out of the mountain beneath Hitler's private chalet. If the Nazi diehards dug in here with their hostages, it would be impossible to dig them out without a bloodbath. Tittmoning was a prison for Dutch officers. One of the first to greet the new arrivals was Captain Michiel van den Heuvel, the officer who had engineered so many of the Colditz escapes. Vandy had a good idea where the Prominente were headed, and, as usual, he had an escape plan ready. The following evening, Giles Romilly and a Dutch officer hid in the ditch running along the inside of the ramparts. Soon after midnight, under a moon of brilliant power and size, they lowered themselves 90 feet into the moat. On the way down, Romilly tore the skin off his knuckles as the bedsheet rope twisted and sent him swinging into the rock face. Moon, castle, space, world in one bowl. At the bottom, they scrambled down a bank and onto the road. Following a compass as tiny and miraculous as a wren's eye, they headed in what they hoped was the direction of the railway station. There, if their luck held out, they might catch a train to Munich. The peace of the night amazed us. It was beyond reasonable hope. While Romilly marvelled at the embracing silence of the Alps, his companions immured themselves in Titmoning Castle. Van den Hervel led them to a deep window recess, where the ancient wall was some 8 feet thick. The Dutchman got down on his hands and knees and, by the light of a small torch, began to ease a knife blade between the great stone blocks that formed the wall. A stone slid out and revealed a hole just large enough for us to wriggle through one by one. A short tunnel led to a chamber, 3 feet square and 12 feet high. When the Germans discovered they were missing, Vandy predicted, they would assume all the British prisoners, with Wynant, had escaped by the same route as Romilly. He could supply them with sufficient food and water to remain hidden for a week. By the end of that time, the war might be won. The five officers crammed inside. The Maori orderly was not invited. The Polish contingent elected not to take part and could not have been accommodated anyway. There was so little space that two had to lie side by side in the tunnel. One stood, the fourth perched on an upper ledge, and the fifth on a lavatory bucket. To avoid cramp, they changed places every 2 hours. Michael Alexander slept not a wink that first night, wondering how long we would have to spend in this intolerably ill-appointed hole. The Swiss official, Rudolf Denzler, was back in Bern, awaiting the end of the war, when a message arrived from the British delegate of the Foreign Interest Section in Geneva. Marked very urgent, it listed the names of the Prominente and described how they had been removed from Colditz by the SS and taken to an unknown destination. It ended with an earnest request. Ascertain immediately where these prisoners are being kept. Undertake everything possible to assure their safety and well-being, and warn the German authorities most solemnly that any failure in this matter will have the most serious consequences for those responsible. Denzler had a hunch where they might be headed. We had every reason to assume that the leaders of the Third Reich were contemplating making a last stand in the Alps. He climbed into his little Swiss car and headed back into Nazi Germany. The Colditz prisoners were ordered to assemble, with whatever possessions they could carry, in the inner courtyard at 10 a.m. By 11 a.m., none had appeared. At 11:10, the senior officers were brought to the commandant's office. "Why is the parade not ready?" Pravit demanded. "I have changed my mind," Todd said quietly. "We are not prepared to leave the castle." The warning from their collaborators in the village had given him time to formulate a plan with Florimond Duke and the senior French officer. "Then the prisoners will be moved by force," Pravit snapped. Todd bit back. "By force? Have you no idea of what is happening out there? The Americans are only 20 miles away. They will be here in a few hours." "That is not our information," Pravit said stiffly. Todd ignored him and continued, "If you attempt to use force, then I must warn you that we shall resist, and then there will be bloodshed. How will you explain this bloodshed when the Americans arrive?" "We've been waiting for this day for a long time," Duke added. "Now, with freedom only hours away, not you nor anybody else will ever get these men out of Colditz." Given how much of that time had been spent trying to get out of Colditz, this was quite a funny remark, albeit unintentional. No one smiled. Pravit picked up the telephone and asked to be put through to the area command headquarters at Glauchau. The men in the room could hear only one side of the conversation, but the gist was clear. Yes, General, I have already given the order. Yes, General, but they refuse to obey. Yes, General, I have indeed warned them, but it makes no difference. There will undoubtedly be bloodshed. The debate raged back and forth, with the commandant desperately trying to pass liability to the general, and the general passing it back. Finally, Pravit lost patience. General, will you accept responsibility for what will happen here? There was a brief pause. Then neither will I, Pravit snarled, and slammed down the receiver. A man hollowed of all authority, the commandant slowly turned to Todd. What do you want me to do? At exactly 11:30 a.m. on the 14th of April 1945, control of Colditz passed from the guards to the prisoners. Eggers was quietly relieved. We would never have got the prisoners out, and even if we had, no one relished the prospect of trying to keep them together on a trek in the path of the advancing Russians. He began destroying evidence. All day, five guards shoveled sacks of documents into the boiler. By midnight, the vast sea of paper that told the bureaucratic story of the prison had gone up in smoke. But Eggers was a historian. The artifacts of the Colditz Museum were carefully packed into boxes and stacked in the cellar. With punctilious propriety, every item of personal property confiscated from the prisoners on arrival was returned to them, 1,400 objects in all, fountain pens, knives, British banknotes. The American Colonel Schaefer, under sentence of death in the solitary cells, was released. In the theatre, the men who had once stitched costumes and fake uniforms began sewing flags, Polish, French, and British, to fly from the ramparts when the moment of liberation came. Now the Germans began to pack, one small suitcase each. The wheel was turning at bewildering speed. The sounds of gunfire were coming closer. American artillery shells began bursting within sight of the castle. "We think the SS might move into the castle," Todd told Pravit. "We request that you give us the keys to the arsenal. We will arm the prisoners to defend it from the SS." Again, Duke chimed in. "You have much more to fear from the SS than the Americans." With extreme reluctance, Pravit handed over the keys to the ammunition depot and weapons stores, on the understanding that these would not be distributed to prisoners unless the SS tried to take over the castle. In the meantime, the German sentries would continue to patrol as usual. The SS could not be allowed to know that Pravit had already surrendered. If they saw white flags or Allied flags exposed, they would almost certainly storm into the castle, precipitating a bloody battle. The charade carried a risk. If the advancing Americans were unaware that the castle had changed hands, they might attack it. There was one piece of paperwork to be completed. Todd handed the commandant a sheet of paper. In consequence of the correct behaviour of Lieutenant Colonel Pravit and his officers in handing over the camp, no reprisal measures will be taken. Every protection will be afforded them and their families. The NCOs and men will be released as soon as possible. The Germans would be absolved of responsibility for whatever had happened in the past, save in two specific cases: the death of Michael Sinclair and the fate of the Prominente. Pravit signed. His defeat was complete. The document had no legal status and made promises that could not be guaranteed. At most, it was a gentleman's agreement, a last gesture of military decency in a prison that had always prided itself on being run by gentlemen, four gentlemen. Colditz had seen many unlikely theatrical productions over the years, but nothing as bizarre as the drama now unfolding. The German garrison was pretending to guard a prison no longer under its control. The inmates were acting as if they were still prisoners, while actually protecting their jailers against both the SS and the advancing American troops. Pravit was performing the part of a commandant, a role now effectively taken over by Colonel Todd. The guards had become prisoners, and the prisoners their guards. The 3rd Battalion of the 273rd Infantry Regiment, the sharp tip of the 1st Army, was advancing fast from the southwest, supported by tanks from the 9th Armoured Division. These American soldiers had been in Europe less than a month, but already they had seen hard fighting in the Ardennes and witnessed terrible things. At Stalag Tekla, a slave labour camp near Leipzig, they found dozens of charred bodies. The inmates had been locked into a mess hall, which had then been set alight. Those who managed to escape the burning buildings were shot. Some appeared to have been electrocuted on the outer wire. Colonel Leo Shaughnessy, the commander of the advance force, was tasked with clearing the countryside of resistance and uncovering groups of refugees and Allied prisoners. It was grim and bloody work. "Resistance increased as we approached Leipzig," he wrote. Shaughnessy lost a dozen men at Altenkreuzich, picked off by snipers in the buildings. "We were fighting a lot of 15 and 16-year-old boys," wrote one soldier. "Most of the Americans were not much older, but battle-edged, wary, and as they drew nearer to Colditz, increasingly enraged." Lee Carson rode immediately behind the vanguard. She had once been an object of curiosity and lust, but now the GIs barely noticed the khaki-clad woman in the back seat of a jeep, usually just a few hundred yards from the fighting. Carson wrote in the first person, her vivid eyewitness reports spiced with slang. "Leipzig is a crazy nightmare," she wrote from the shattered city. "Shops, homes and offices are being looted by swarms of civilians. American troops are getting a weird welcome, complete with wine, flowers, cheers and kisses, plus machine pistol and bazooka fire from packs of Hitler's baby gangsters under SS officer direction. Fires spotlight street corners. Tanks rattle and clank up side streets. There is rape and robbery in this town, and no safety for anyone." On Saturday, the 14th of April, the task force made camp west of the Mulder River. Shaughnessy was informed that a large body of prisoners was being held in the vicinity. The orders came through late that evening. "Take Colditz." "The next morning broke," wrote Eggers, "with the breath of spring. Gazing down from the battlements, he could see townsfolk barricading their homes against the gathering storm. Nature carried on, but men and women took cover, wondering who would die by nightfall." Soon after 9 a.m, the first Sherman tanks appeared on the western horizon, emerging from a wheat field. Cheko Kalupka spotted them through his lecherscope and let out a great whoop of joy. Colonel Shaughnessy deployed his artillery in the forest above the village of Hohenbach and ordered the battery commanders to target the most prominent aiming point across the river, the towers of a rather large and imposing castle. 6 Thunderbolt fighters streaked over the town, strafed the railway station, and the German artillery dug in among the trees above the park and swung away. There was no answering anti-aircraft fire. In both the Kommandantur and the prisoners' quarters, spectators crammed at the windows to witness the battle for Colditz. Some climbed onto the battlements. Just after midday, the first 2-inch American shell slammed into the guardroom by the main gate. A second crashed through the 3rd-floor window of the room occupied by Douglas Bader. The legless fighter pilot was down in the courtyard, mocking the guards, repeatedly chanting, "Where is the Luftwaffe?" As Duke observed, by goon baiting to the bitter end, he had saved his life. A third skimmed over the northwest ramparts and landed in the trees. The German 88mm guns in the Tiergarten fired back over the castle, peppering the woods beyond. Kolditz was now smack in the middle of an artillery duel. Then the 6-inch American howitzer shells began falling. One thumped down near the bridge over the dry moat, killing a German sergeant. Two more struck the Kommandantur. The American gunners were zeroing in. Colonel Todd ordered everyone down to the basements, but not before the homemade flags were unfurled from the windows and the letters POW spelled out in bedsheets on the cobbles of the inner courtyard to catch the attention of overflying reconnaissance aircraft. The American barrage slowed and then stopped. We observed three Allied red, white and blue flags appear at the upper windows, wrote Shaughnessy. This thrilling sight was the only signal we needed to know that the castle was the prison where the prisoners of war were being held. Characteristically, David Stirling ignored the shelling and stayed on the roof, with a bird's-eye view of the fighting below. The American tanks and heavy machine guns took up positions on the edge of Kolditz, while two rifle platoons entered the town from the west. The SS were waiting. The American infantry were spread out on the slope above the town allotments when two concealed machine guns opened up. There were so many bullets coming at us that the trees were crackling like they were on fire, wrote Sergeant Roy Verdugo, whose men began dropping to left and right. With covering fire, 22 infantrymen worked their way around the machine guns and into the side streets. As the Americans inched forward, crouching low, hiding behind parked cars, hurling grenades around corners, they were picked off by snipers firing from the upper floors. A Panzerfaust shell blazed into a building, sending up gorgeous splinters of red, yellow, and orange. The American commanding officer, 23-year-old Lieutenant Ryan, was hit by shrapnel. With his left eye hanging from its socket, he screamed, "Assemble in the houses! We're not leaving!" Contact with Shaughnessy's command post was severed when a bullet ripped through the two-way radio. A squad of Germans, SS and Hitler Youth, charged down the main street towards the Americans and were obliterated by a bazooka shell. Several houses were now burning and a thick pall of smoke drifted across the town. Emil Miskiewicz, a Polish-American sergeant from Chicago, was edging up the street leading to the bridge when a young boy, possibly 14 or 15 years old, dressed in a German soldier's uniform, stepped out of his doorway and shot the sergeant in the head. Miskiewicz died instantly. The boy was gunned down, his body left in the roadway, in front of his home. The prisoners returned to the windows and watched transfixed. Many had not seen battle since 1940. Commandos like Mickey Byrne and Michael Alexander had taken part in bloody special operations, and Stirling led his SAS in attacks on the North African airfields. But none had ever witnessed fighting like this. House to house, hand to hand, face to face combat, savage and intimate, pitting an unstoppable trained army against Nazi fanatics and indoctrinated children at the fag end of a ghastly war. It was the most ferocious close quarters fighting Lee Carson had yet seen. The Yank force composed of tanks and infantry from the 9th Armored Division met fierce resistance by well-organized bands of Hitler Youth under command of SS officers. Outnumbered, the Americans pulled back, dragging their dead and wounded. The Volkssturm attempted to destroy the bridge with dynamite, but succeeded only in blowing a hole through the roadway. Half a dozen SS stormtroopers climbed down onto the riverbank and tried to blast the supports with bazookas at close range. But still, the moss-covered Adolf Hitler Bridge stood firm. From the castle heights, the spectators joined in a last chorus of goon-baiting. Their boos and jeers could be distinctly heard by the SS, wrote Duke. Shells from the American howitzers pummeled the town, where Irma Wernicke and her family crouched in a basement. From the Tiergarten came the welcome sound of infantry small arms and machine gun fire. Oberstleutnant Pravit came to find Colonel Duke, a final reversal of their roles. "Your Americans will be here soon," he said. "By tomorrow morning at the latest," Duke replied. "I shall need someone to meet them, someone who can explain that our guards won't resist." The words hung somewhere between an order, a request, and a plea for mercy. At dusk, the American troops crossed the river via the railway bridge north of the town and began cautiously moving downstream. "We cleared the western side of the Mulde by midnight," wrote Shaughnessy. "The cacophony subsided, and the fires burned out." The task force had lost more than a dozen killed, including two platoon sergeants and twice that number wounded. Colonel Shaughnessy gave orders for an attack at daybreak. The Americans settled down for the night in the abandoned houses close to the bridge, where defenders had dragged wire and old iron machinery across the road. The GIs posted guards and tried to sleep, but the wind blowing through the metal debris made a creaking, groaning sound in the eerie emptiness of the night. Gunfire echoed in the darkness. Not the irregular crash and crackle of street fighting now, but volleys at regular intervals, coming from the old China factory on the northeast edge of town. No one, it seems, had known about the slave labour camp for Hungarian Jews on the outskirts of Colditz. The Hugo Schneider Aktien Gesellschaft Metal Warenfabrik, or HASAG, started out in 1889 as a small metal products factory. The company had prospered under Nazi rule, and by 1944 it was one of the largest arms manufacturers in the Reich, with 8 factories in Germany and 3 in Poland. Under the management of Paul Budin, a member of the Nazi Party and a Sturmbannführer, major in the SS, HASAG mass-produced ammunition, small arms and rocket launchers for the German army, using forced labour. More than 20,000 prisoners of various nationalities were made to work in the HASAG labour camps, where Budin ruthlessly applied the policy of Vernichtung durch Arbeit, extermination through work. In all camps, there were regular selections, and those no longer considered fit for work were murdered. The Third Reich was HASAG's only customer. The company paid the SS for each labourer, and the Nazi regime paid HASAG handsomely for its products. HASAG was singled out as an exemplary national socialist enterprise by the Nazi rulers, and Budin received a personal note of thanks from the Führer. Beginning in the summer of 1944, the arms company established 7 satellite units, or Außenkommandos, employing Jewish slave labourers from the Buchenwald concentration camp. The smallest of these, Außenkommando 24, was located inside the old Steingut fabric building at Colditz, once the largest China factory in Germany, with a labour force of around 700 Hungarian Jews producing armaments for the German war effort. Conditions inside the HASAG camps were appalling. The prisoners lacked sanitation and running water. The morning ersatz coffee was so disgusting that some preferred to use it to wash themselves before performing 12 hours of punishing physical work, assembling guns and explosives. Beatings were frequent. Supper was a bowl of thin soup with a small piece of bread. They slept in unheated wooden barracks on straw mattresses or bare wood. The dead were frequently left in the open for days, where they had fallen. One survivor, Charles Kutkowski, described a world of utter degradation. There were no baths to take care of millions of lice, so he had to undress and stand naked waiting at a wall. After freezing for half an hour, they unleashed several fire hoses on us, and not everyone was able to withstand that. Each thrust of water in the cold weather knocked us against the wall. Life expectancy in a Hasag Aussen commando was 3.5 months. Irma Wernicke and her spies appear to have been unaware of the camp's existence. Even Reinhold Eggers claimed he had known nothing about the Jewish labourers in the old factory, slaves for the Nazi war machine. They were in the charge of an SS unit, with whom we in the castle had practically no contact at all, Eggers wrote. This was an SS matter. It hardly seems credible that a small army of slaves could have passed unnoticed in a town that size. But people are skilled at seeing and remembering what they want to. A great deal has been written about Colditz over the years, but little has been recorded about the other camp, just a few hundred yards away, where Jews were being worked and starved to death. The German occupation of Hungary, in which Mission Sparrow played such an unheroic part, had been followed by the mass deportation of the country's Jews. Some 434,000 people, more than half the total Jewish population of Hungary, were transported to camps. Most were taken to Auschwitz, where 80% were gassed on arrival. Some were selected for slave labour. No one knows the exact number of Hungarian Jews taken to Hasag Aussen Commando 24 at Colditz, when they arrived, and how many had already perished from exhaustion, disease, and malnutrition. But as the defeated German forces prepared to pull out, the SS guards set about systematically murdering the Jewish prisoners in batches of 5. The shooting stopped just before daybreak.